Media objects' relations with law has altered. The coexistence of the obsolete film with its meme and digitally remastered copy in the age of media convergence provokes us to rethink categories of censorship and authorship on media objects and their inherent mutability in networked digital domain. The paper engages with the item numbers changing relations with law and technology, with a focus on the body as a central, as the central node of inquiry. The metaphor of the sexualized body constantly informs the legal lexicon that governs the body that moves on the screen and the body that is moved by the screen. However, Web 2.0's design for remixability and hackability not only provides newer connotations to this metaphor of the sexualized body, but also renders its associations with the legal domain obfuscated, ambiguous, and thus malleable. The paper deals with the changing, with the changing registers of the sexualized body in the legal encounters of the item number, a change that is primarily driven by technology, ranging from the bilateral issue of the on-screen dance numbers and live dancing in places of public entertainment, to censorship debates in music licensing, to the multiple platforms of television, YouTube, Vivo, Wink, Gaana, Savan, etc., and the issues of legal concern in the viral mutations that item numbers undergo in user traffic-driven web platforms. Sexuality has always been the nodal point for expressing anxieties. With the case of decertification of Himanshu Rai's 1930 film, A Throw of Dice, because of its infamous kiss, Derek Bose points out that control of cinema during British legislation, which was under the jurisdiction of police, allowed kissing sequences in foreign imports. The kiss, however, became a taboo in Indian productions, and the audience gradually became accustomed to strange jump cuts. From the mid-1930s, puritanical energies driven by the rise of film journalism, nationalist, feudal, bourgeois interest in the pedagogic possibilities of the medium, as well as activist efforts aimed at creating a panoptic monitoring gaze of Indian culture, curbing any expression of visible female sexuality. Actually, visible sexuality rather than female sexuality. It tempered the bazaar energies and cultural miscegenation, and I'm quoting from Kaushik Bhaumik here, in the form of variegated peripatetic aesthetics and bourgeois monumental style that had helped shape early film culture in Bombay and paved the way for the consolidation of a Hindu ethnoscape in Bombay cinema. In the 50s, a society for the prevention of unhealthy trends in motion pictures was formed under prominent figures like Leelavati Munshi and K.M. Munshi. But it has to be noted that within the film industry, there was discontent against the censor board. Legal anxiety over unbridled circulation of the immoral continued to proliferate through the 90s. Liberalization of the economy, satellite television network, and the dot-com boom being the major players in this. At this critical juncture of legal and moral turmoil, musical digressions of the year in the form of standard cabaret or the folk dance sequences, as well as the sleazy semi-pornographic dances from the B circuit, found a passage to cross over to the mainstream. Getting to cohort with the respectable, the new figure of the item girl attained the celebrity status of fashion icons, marked by an open female sexuality that became aspirational for the middle-class female spectators and desirable for many. The numbers were marked by a virality which was distinct from the cabaret sequences. Their virality, essentially a publicity prop being circulated round the clock through promos on satellite television. Private television channels accept a standardized code of conduct for their 24-hour programming with repeat hours cut out for adult content and not subject to the whims of the censor board. But censorship is productive. A censored object becomes marketable because the act of censorship is known, be it the case of Choli Ke Piche Kya Hai's popularity through audio cassettes and private cable channels, or the numerous outlaw dance numbers restricted to the B film circuit, which often circulated through pirate video networks or inserted as cut pieces spliced onto the celluloid reels during theatrical projection. Censored content have its own affective following. I have a poster here, and you can see the A, and it's stated Keval Vayashko Ke Liye censored, releasing shortly. So the news of the censorship becomes a publicity prop for a film. And I can tell you this poster acquired only 1/8 of the total page of screen from where I got it. And there are many such posters through the 90s, actually. Dance for the sake of public entertainment has always been interconnected with notions of civic morality and had its own ambiguous relationship to law. Even in the 80s, the Indian state made allowances for live performances of striptease, noting that, and I'm quoting from Sadhana versus the State case 1981, it would not be possible to convict a cabaret dancer merely because a section of the people not attending such shows equate them, perhaps rightly, with pornography and feel annoyed and disturbed at the level of entertainment made accessible so openly. Cabarets are shown all over the world and they have also gyrated to Delhi. And unless there is a special legislation to ban them, it will be a misuse of Section 294 Indian Penal Code to punish the entertainers and organizers of such shows. But the language of official and legally ordained public morality changed at the later half of the 90s. As Ratna Kapoor points out, that the controversies surrounding the cultural regulations were bolstered by a cobweb of legal rules, regulations, and administrative guidelines designed to regulate sexual and other speech. Article 19.2, Section 292, Indian Indecent Representations of Women's Act, 1986, and the Section 5B of the Cinematography Act of 1952. The event of the dance bar ban in Bombay sparked off with tussles between the state and owners of lowbrow restaurants which served their guests with alcoholic drinks along with live dance performances to Hindi film songs over legal licensing of these dance bars. Most of these bars, as Flavia Agnes points out, were operating without a license or often dodged the revised rates of the license fee. The raids carried out in these thus booked the owners under Section 33 of the Bombay Police Act and Section 3 of Bombay Entertainment Duty Act. While star establishments like Tabela and Sensation in Delhi, The Cellar in Bombay, and Mughal Room, Polynesia, and Princess in Calcutta, all under the aegis of the Oberoi Grand, East India Hotels, were exempted with an increased entertainment tax under the laws that permit live dancing in star hotels which cater to foreign tourists and other guests who pay money to purchase special tickets to enjoy the dances. The ecology of the dance bar, which was till the early 2000s compared to that of the primitive performances of the fairground, the Tamasha Lavni Playhouse, or the cinema house of the colonial period, based on purely economic grounds, suddenly mutated into issues of the obscene sexualized bodies compared to the Hindi filmic bodies that require state control. Sections 292 and 294 were invoked to carry out the arrest and raid of the bar dancers. The focus shifted from the unauthorized establishments to the bodies of the dancers. The second recommendation, prepared by a 2004 committee formed by a government directive to control undesirable practices in hotel establishments, and I'm quoting from that recommendation, there should be a railing of 3 feet height adjacent to the dance stage. There should be a distance of 5 feet between the railing and seats for the customers. It signposts the lexicon of law that sexualizes the physical space of the dance bar, a body with an overt sex drive that needs to be bound by railings. Shantanu Gupta, screenwriter for Anjaam, directed by Rahul Ravel in 1994, says, and I quote him, "The censor board arguments are always about 5 feet and 10 feet and 2 feet. Cut this off and cut that off." His remark points out a similar taxonomy of control that operates in the censor board's attempts at sexualizing the filmic material, the unruly celluloid that requires snipping. It is interesting to note that the high point of the petitioners, the bar dancers, against the state order was that since their choreography, costume, and choice of music is all borrowed from the template of Hindi film dancers, dance songs, notably the item numbers, bar dancing should not be banned. The coexistence and cross-referencing of bar dancing and filmic item numbers is a case of new mass media and older forms of performance remediating and amplifying each other. The legal regulation of both unwittingly sexualizes them. It is no coincidence that with the dance bar ban in 2005, the item numbers of Bombay cinema went missing for a while and metamorphosed into a new glamorized avatar. Shorn of its formulaic aesthetics, the item number began to capitalize on the stardom of the performer. The dance bar item number resurfaced in 2013, the year when the Supreme Court allowed the bar owners of Bombay to reapply for their licenses with Shootout at Wadala, directed by Sanjay Gupta, a period film which possibly allows dance bar song sequences. Censorship, which is essentially a state machinery, as Monica Mehta says, the legal juridical apparatus that is crucial for the reproduction of the state regulating the bodies of its people, insidiously regulates filmic images too, even when it does not directly control it. What comes up in my conversation with Ira Bhaskar, a former member of the CBFC, and also after going through multiple censor certificates for films with item numbers, is the fact that most of them are let off with reduced durations or blurred shots of female anatomy. Rarely are mandatory cuts made on item numbers. Here one needs to rethink categories that one has been working with in terms of obscenity and law. If a hypersexual dance number does not raise the ire of the CBFC, then what forms the new register of obscenity? At this point, legal regulation of the on-screen dancing body performs a different order of control. The camera that penetrates into the details of female anatomy is withdrawn from another detail, the graver problem for the state. Direct violence in the form of carnage and rape are explicit representations of on-screen sex. Two posters for company, director Ram Gopal Varma, 2002, had the item number as an identifiable attraction in the film. While in one, the item girl occupies one half of the poster. You can see the poster on the right. And in the other two, the title of the item number is kept in the center of the two posters. You can see Khallas there, while the stars are pushed off to the corners. The poster preempts the role played by the item in not only fracturing the narrative of the film, but also in the withdrawal of the camera from the main thrust of the film. Depictions of organized gang violence. The song comes 40 minutes into the film after the sequence of Chandu and Malik bumping off the rivals within the Aslam gang, after which the duo go on a bloody rampage, killing off all other gangsters and pulling the reins of the underworld. But the rampage is not shown on screen. Instead, Malik blows into his fuming gun after shooting the brothers, flicks the cigarette and clarifies to Chandu, "In our business, forgiving a mistake is a bigger mistake than that," and the sequence breaks into the song. Within the song, the spectator hears the parallel soundtrack of Makran Deshpande's voiceover announcing that Chandu and Malik went on a rampage in the next 48 hours and the sound of bullets. The palpable violence inherent in the stylized lyrics of the song, "Nahi Duja Mauka Bachke Tu Rehna Khallas," which roughly translates as "No second chance, stay safe," overwhelms and undercuts the unseen violence announced by the voiceover. So I'll quickly play the video. I'll show another item number which performs a different function of censorship. So this is Azara Kareeb Se. What did I do? Shit. Okay, wait. What? Did I just pause it? This is Mahesh Bhatt's attempt at making a slasher without spilling one drop of blood on screen. And this item number, which is the opening credit song, is the only hint in the film that the spectator gets of what is to come, although nothing of it is actually happening on screen. But the song as an object is also an object of censorship, because this song was censored and it had to be reshot with the protagonist of the film for the television version. I'm sorry for not letting you listen to the entire, or rather see the entire song. With a major shift of spectators from the monopoly of the television small screen to the internet-enabled more haptic personal devices, the record labels have bifurcated their distribution to YouTube along with the traditional television music channels. The recognition of the change in music consumption pattern has changed the distribution and licensing policies of the production houses and music companies. The introduction of the free play period on television prior to official licensing deals and the multiple versions of the same song on YouTube is a marker of this. While televisual programs which capitalize on any kind of mutation of the original music content are strictly monitored by the copyright laws, content on YouTube is free-floating, fashioned to the whims of the amateur artist, remixed and photoshopped. Proliferation of digital platforms has not only granted smooth breach of copyright laws, but has encouraged the seamless coexistence of the multiple low-res user uploads with the record label's official uploads of digitized versions of pre-digital era videos. All record labels come with censor certificates, says Eva. And Eva is the she is one of the marketing partners for 9XM, a television music channel. She says, censorship regulations for distribution over YouTube are different from television channels. YouTube videos do not require censor certification, unlike the record labels licensed to music channels. YouTube has an international standard for the regulation of uploads, which might be proper for general viewing. If a song fails to meet those standards, YouTube sets an age gate to the video and asks the user for age verification by signing into the portal. Television channels are rule-bound to play content according to censor guidelines. The production house sends different versions of the song to the music companies, one of which contains the edits, blurs, and deletes marked out by the censor board. Songs with objectionable details licensed to music channels are played according to the censor guidelines. In an interview with Aishwarya and Prashant from the T-Series team, that in the case of Ragini MMS2, the promo video was censored, which then could not be played on television. The song thus had to be reshot. Although YouTube has a category of Red Bank content which allows trailers with adult content to be uploaded, the production house decided on releasing the braless full video song Baby Doll only after the theatrical release of the film. It's really unfortunate that fake users had already uploaded several photoshopped versions of the same song before that, says Aishwarya. And she was hinting to the Bhojpuri remix of the song, which had the braless version. And that song is called Gori Gori Hamari Badaniya. You can stream it on YouTube and check it. The film was categorized as restricted to adults and released with four minor edits, replacement with blurred shots of the bare breasts in the bathtub, but no deletion or edit was added to the bare breasts in the sequence in which Sunny Leonid drifts up and lands on a pile of hands dressed in black. The sequence was found in major theaters. My own experience of watching Ragini MMS2 on the big screen was no different than others. On the big screen in a semi-decent multiplex, PVR Priya Basant Lok, New Delhi. The much publicized item number was the opening credit song, and within 30 seconds into the number, the bare breast came as a surprise. It created a huge uproar, followed by a huge uproar in the audience. A flurry of whistles and hooting was followed by a rather opprobrious rocking of several seats. But the most preposterous act was yet to come. The desire for repeat viewing and recording the previously unseen, inflamed by the availability of cheap digital technology in smartphones, is such that a fellow audience member had to be disgraced and booted out of the theater by the security guards. The act of censure at this point is no longer simply against a breach of copyright, but also signposts the deliberate deployment of surveillance technology to deter the technologically enabled body of the user, whose response to the screen is proprioceptive, one that allows him to fleetingly shift his attention across the screens of the theater and his devices, engaging with both at a haptic precognitional level. The legal issue underlying the entire process. Surveillance and law enforcement is possible at physical sites of reception. The uncharted terrain of amateur digital culture, signifying a form of fan labor, which constantly updates the Web 2.0 programs and thus sustains the internet, whose sustainability is dependent on constant fan user updates, may not be difficult to monitor, but it opens up a zone of ambiguity where the law appears vague and often fails the test of reasonableness. Memetic humor, which is often provocative in nature, is difficult to tap down in concrete terms owing to its apparent loss of original material substance, its material unit of measurement and transmission. As Tony D. Sampson notes, that the meme is a self-copying message that spreads without any organized unit or body. It spreads virally. Its parasitical fitness works via an evolutionary algorithm without being dependent on a single mechanism. The meme is thus a code that attaches itself to the medium and helps metamorphose media cultural objects in the process. What is interesting here is that the meme, which signposts the bodilessness of digital data, overwhelms any legal infrastructure. The lack of a proximate, touchable body of media object disallows any juridical injunction to operate on it. Instead, the legal juridical apparatus is stringent on the body of the user, body of the framer of digital data, the proprioceptive body of the fan user who appropriates the memetic code and contributes to the endless circle of remixes around it. Such a body makes use of electronic quasi-embodied forms of interactivity, kinesis and eroticism, downloading, morphing and uploading, and forming a tactile bond with the image throughout, marking a culture that is participatory and self-absorbed at the same time. Cases of starlets getting trolled on the microblogging platform Twitter are on the rise, the more vulnerable ones being the small-time female performers, often B-grade, attempting to gain celebrity glamour by doing hypersexualized stunts in Bollywood. Kamal Rashid Khan, one of the most ill-reputed trolls on Twitter, had a long-drawn tiff with Sunny Leone, attributing words to her Twitter handle that the actor denied to have posted herself. Although he had faced lawsuits under Section 66 for making racist remarks against actor Dhanush in 2013, Kamal Rashid Khan had tweeted, and I quote him, "Yelo, Sunny Leone says, rape is not a crime, it is just a surprise sex." Sunny Leone is quoted to say, "The whole issue is quite sad. I have never made this statement at all. No woman in the entire world would." He had written it and tagged me on it. He has not retweeted my comment and lodged a complaint with the Cybercrime Investigation Cell of Mumbai Police against Kamal Rashid Khan for falsely attributing controversial comments on rape to her on his microblogging page. She also says, and again I quote her, "Post the incident, my web team has been diligently blocking people who have been retweeting his comments. A year ago, Khan tweeted, 'I request to Digvijay Singh ji to have a strip show of Sunny Leone in the function of his marriage, and I will pay rupees 1 crore to the Congress Party Fund,' forcing the actor to seek legal help once again." Oh, I missed this. Oh, this is something that I almost pirated out of Ira Bhaskar's computer. So this is from the minutes of the meeting that the censor board had after Dirty Picture received a lot of complaints after it was broadcast on Sony on an afternoon slot. And this is the new definition of vulgarity. You can have a quick look at it. Not that it changed anything. Yeah. All right. And this is Kamal Arkhan's new tweet about Sunny Leone. Such malicious trolling on microblogging platforms is a throwback to electronic communication technologies of early 90s, like VR, which empowered, as Anne Balsamo and Mark Derry points out, antisocial behaviors such as flaming, electronic insults and borderline illegal behaviors such as trespassing, email snooping and mud rape, unwanted aggressive sexual textual encounter in a multi-user domain. While the impulse behind such flame wars was rather a niche activity carried out by participants of an electronically configured subculture, namely the techno-frenzied cyberpunks, the trolls, lolcats, image macros, and other forms of contemporary memetic transmission of messages move across the digital network, cutting an arc from the invisible troll to the hypervisible meme on social media pages. They not only make more people conversant with the images themselves, but also rely on a certain level of awareness already existing. The question of its virality, wider dissemination also ropes in the question of law as redress. In a reply to my question about the legal infrastructure binding amateur activities online, Debarshi Banerjee, one of the founders of Scoop Poop Media, says, As such, there is no legal framework around it, not even around provocative image macros and trolling, except the IT Protection Act. But harassment is harassment. If someone is offended by anything posted online, can seek legal help under Section 66. Reddit, 9gag, 4chan work through user-generated uploads. They are free spaces and one can't put a censor on that. They work through algorithms that push content out to people. They are not managed by anyone. However, in creative media spaces like Scoop Poop, BuzzFeed India, or any other curated platform, all content is vetted by a team of editors. The comments section to every listicle is a free space that we allow the users to engage with. But somewhere we need to draw the line. So, for example, in most of our listicles and blogs on item numbers, we receive some comments which border on lewdness, like users sharing hyperlinks to stories of wardrobe malfunction, leaked videos, and casting couch. However, there are others which are absolutely pornographic, often directly criminal, hinting at rape, etc. Comments like, hey, check out this blah, blah, blah URL, or yet others who try to do unnecessary marketing like, oh, stop reading these yap bag lists about hot women, work for me, and earn X amount of money in Y hours. We do not publish these. In curated platforms, we are responsible for the content we put up. We don't want to enter legal hassles for supporting unbridled user activity. Thus, we have kept the option of reviewing the comments before they get uploaded. Okay. The operation of law thus points out that cinema, which was earlier marked by an endogamous national culture fettered by censorship, distribution quotas, music licensing, Doordarshan, import-export duties, has now bled out into its intermedial interstices, which make the media object's relation with the legal domain appear volatile. The body idiom constantly fettered by law in item numbers acquired the capacity to combine and scavenge on disparate influences intersecting at avenues of global life, transnational commerce, high fashion, YouTube videos, international travel, gadgetry, consumer goods, as well as digitally enabled hipster Hindutva, moving out of the cinema to live its own life as one of the multiple effects. Thank you.